Hi, this is David Sweet, founder of Focus Core, and I'd like to invite you to take a look at our 2024 salary guide. It's a great resource for hiring APAC professionals wanting to know about the salaries for executive positions within Japan, as well as finding out information of what's important to attract the best talent in Japan. The salary guide is found on our website under About Salary Guide 2024. I hope you find this information useful for you and your company. Now, on to our podcast. Welcome to the Focus Core podcast. I'm your host, David Sweet, founder and CEO of Focus Core. Today, I'm joined by William Neely Jr., who is an articulate and dynamic professional of leadership development and organizational development, who's worked with some world-class organizations within Japan. William is originally from Kansas City, Missouri. He's a huge sports enthusiast. We'll speak a lot about sports, particularly around tennis. In this episode, we will talk about how sports relates to business. We'll touch upon Jim Lehrer, who, if you don't know, is a sports psychologist and someone that is very influential within bringing sports and business together. We're going to talk about company values and how William has helped create company values for his current organization. We'll talk about how organizational development can help companies grow, how companies can do better, and some easy wins to develop their staff, some pitfalls that they can avoid, and in general, hopefully you'll walk away after listening to this podcast with having one or two omiyage to take back to your organization and implement to help grow your staff. So I bring you William Neely Jr.
He's sweet, Dr. Sweet. I've been waiting to say that. It's good to see you. Good to see you.
Nice.
Good to be here.
Obviously, we've known each other for some time. We share a lot of the background with, we both came over on Jet for a bit. We both have been in Rotary in some form or another. Mm-hmm. You were growing up in Kansas City, I in Denver. So we have some animosity there, which we might get into later. But but before we get started, can you summarize your background and your path that's led you to doing learning and development with some of the industry leaders in Japan?
Sure. Yeah. So like you said, I first came over on the JET program. So that's when I got into education, I guess. It probably starts there, right? I mean, I'm in learning and development, which is at its core, it's facilitation, it's teaching, it's program design. And a lot of that stuff was started during the JET program. You know, and I had studied Japanese in university. So that's how I kind of went into the JET program. I was in Oita City for 3 years, the mid 90s. I remember mid 90s, before the internet. Yeah. And I got the letter from JET from Momokagakusho.
Yeah.
Saying I'm going to Oita. And I remember, what's Oita? I got out an actual atlas, a book, to search. I'm looking all around. Okay, it's in the south. Great, cool. Oita is in Kyushu. So anyway, just to give a sense of how far back this goes, you know, my Japan experience, my first Japan days. So 3 years on the JET program in Kyushu. And then I left for about 7 years and lived different parts of the world, basically still, you know, kind of learning and growing. I lived in Europe for a while, in Barcelona, in the West Coast, in LA, San Francisco, Las Vegas, doing various things, basically, I guess, becoming a man. Mm-hmm. And then I did a couple of years working at the Japanese consulate in my hometown in Kansas City, where I'm from. And so that was my reconnection back to Japan and the Japanese government, I guess. And that was a connection to Japan. And that was also a connection into Rotary, which the Consul General at the time introduced me to a program called the Rotary World Peace Fellowship Program. And that was, you know, he said, are you interested in peace studies?
Yeah.
And at the time I thought he was saying peace studies as in the letter P. And I said, yeah, that sounds great. I looked it up later, peace studies. So that was how I became introduced into the world of peace education and peace work. And that took me back to Japan. I spent 2 years as a Rotary World Peace Fellow at ICU, which is International Christian University in Mitaka. And that was in 2004. So I came thinking I was going to be there for 2 years. But during that time, I met my now wife. And so put down roots. I went into recruiting at first.
Yeah.
After I graduated from ICU, I did executive recruiting for 2 years, Gaishikei companies mainly. And then I went into leadership development in a company called Impact, Impact International. And it's a European company. They're based in England. They do leadership, team, communication, et cetera. And so I worked there for 5 years. And then I went into in-house into talent and learning manager at Adidas.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that much detail I should go into these things. You want kind of a summary, maybe just sort of a.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we can break it apart when we get there.
So, talent and learning development at Adidas for 5 years. Great experience there. Part of that in Japan, part of that in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I left Adidas in 2018, when I was in the US. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, came back to Japan, worked at Nissan in global talent.
Yep.
So in the headquarters in Yokohama, and I was there for around 2 years. And then that was a whole other experience.
Yep.
Crazy, you know, during a lot of the drama that was happening. It's been drama kind of every place I've gone, and I'm not the cause. I don't think there's other people, but I get into it. It's a good way to see how the world works. And then after Adidas and after Nissan, is when I was recruited to go into my current company, which is Cartier. And I've been at Cartier as a senior manager for learning and development for 2 years. And I'm not talking to you today as a representative, as you know, of Cartier. Yep. I'm here as myself, but that's where I work.
Yeah. We'll talk about L&D, and I'd like to dive into that a little bit, because that's my background, right? Mm-hmm. Employee development, learning development. And I still, even in recruitment, I consider myself an educator. And I think that's where we hit it off when you were at Impact, and we were looking at different paths for you as well for back in the day, right?
Yeah.
But one of the other passions that we share, and one of the things that you haven't talked about, is sport. And you're the man out on the tennis court.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Some people might beg to differ, and I, you know, but I play a lot. I've been playing my whole life. It's a big part of my life for sure.
How do you think, and you know, we've talked about this online, offline, but let's bring it online. How do you feel that sport relates to business for you?
Well, I think, you know, there are so many cliches about it. I mean, and, you know, business is war, or business is, you know, zero sum, and, or, you know, lessons learned, or sports builds character, or sports reveals character. There's all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think there's truth in that. You know, there's some kernel of truth in all of that. I think where I connect with it more is maybe, you know, on a visceral level, right? Like, we can always be better.
Mm-hmm.
You lose, it hurts, but there's lessons in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's about not being satisfied with a certain result, but also not beating yourself up when you don't have the result. So really what it boils down to, what, you know, and it's taken me many years to come to this point, and but it's I think the core of it is around a growth mindset.
Oh, I like that.
The thing that if you try harder, you can be better.
Mm.
We have strengths and weaknesses. Everybody has strengths and weaknesses. It's about how do you minimize your development points? How do you strengthen the development areas? But also, how do you use your strengths to the maximum? You know, and everybody's different. You know, we're diverse, we're people. And in business and in sports, you have strengths, you have weaknesses. But how do you maximize and minimize the things that are going to help you perform better? And I think that's the core of it. And there's so much more that goes into that. I mean, as you know, personality, all these different things. But at the core, I think that's the common thread for me between sports and business.
Mm. I know when I'm recruiting folks, one of the things I growing up, I was not an athlete. I didn't like sport. But I've learned the importance of, like you say, that core, that the getting better. And part of what, like in a marathon, I'm not going to go out and beat Kipchoge, but I can go out and beat myself from what I did previously. And it's that incremental improvement. It's the, I always like to use the persistent consistency,
mm-hmm.
where it's about practicing, and it's almost, it's learning a craft, and there's not an endpoint. It's a continual spectrum, and there's not, whereas so many things we look for a goal. And I think around sport, there might be winning, there might be a cup, there might be a tournament that you shoot for, but it's still after that, there's still that consistent improvement. And I think that always improving is so important within that sport mindset.
Absolutely.
We had talked about, when I went back to the U.S., I was lucky enough to meet Jim Lehrer, and the Dr. Lehrer, who worked a lot in mental toughness training in sports, specifically tennis. Right, that's where he did his sport is, and that guy's amazing.
What context did you meet him in? What kind of, was it in a conference, or you met him somewhere? Or
went over to, so I was at my previous company, and I was looking to move to Florida. And so I was looking for a job. So, and he and I both went to school at Regis University in Denver.
Okay.
And so I sat down with him and was asking about work and doing some employee development for his group over there. And since we had taken so much of his materials and incorporated it into our sales team, and that mental toughness training in sport was a huge part in how do you take the 5 to 10 specific points, elements of your job, and incrementally improve on your lowest points and work on those. And we called it WIN. We improve now, and we had WIN partners, and we would sit down each week with a WIN partner in the organization, and, you know, be held accountable. And that was all from Jim Lehrer.
Okay. I didn't know about that part. That's cool. Yeah. I said I've been playing tennis since I'm a little boy. One of the first people I remember hearing about was him. Even, you know, before Balotelli, even.
Yeah.
I think. I must have been 8 or 9. My mom went to Dennis Vandermeer. Do you know who, have you heard of?
No,
he's got an academy. He, it was in South Carolina, Hilton Head, South Carolina, and Dr. Lohr, Jim Lohr, had a 1 week mental toughness training that he did. And my mom went there for that. I must have been eight, it was early 80s sometime. And she came back and was telling me about it. So I remember hearing his name. It stuck with me. And then later on in life, when he came up in the context of business and, you know, self-improvement and other kinds of toughness in different contexts, he was already familiar. But I've known about him for a long time, but I have not met him myself.
He's a nice guy. For our listeners who don't know him, his main study was that most tennis players have the same physical capabilities. They're in tip-top shape. And so what he studied was the time between the points, that mental point where you got the ball and you're getting ready to serve between the play. And that was the sliver of time that he worked on with athletes to improve, right? And I think in business, I manage sales teams, and it's a mental game for a lot of these salespeople, because a lot of times they might win or they might lose, but it's in between those sales.
What do you do?
What do you do?
I still talk to my mom almost every week, and tennis is one of the big things because she's still playing, competing, and I'm competing. Wow. But we talk about this kind of stuff. What they did in one of the things that I remember the most that they did at that 1 week thing, that camp that she went to, was they had them playing, they had them playing points, and then they had the other people in the part of the camp would be in the stands on the side. And so it's my mom's turn to play a set or a few games, and the people on the side were throwing stuff on the court, you know, hollering, you suck, or, you know, whatever it might be, you know, really trying to distract them as much as possible. Right.
Yeah.
Which is way beyond what you would have in an actual tennis situation. But how do you respond to that? You know, what are the things that are going to help you trigger keeping you in the space, your optimum zone or whatever, not get distracted. Don't let that bother you. Don't take things personally, whatever it might be. And one of them is a mantra. One of the things is, what can you say? Your easily repeatable phrase, a word, couple words that can bring you back into that place, right? And it's something that, so I've been trying to do that with varying levels of success, and I do it in business too now. You know, like you say, where are the commonalities? Like, what are the actual things that you can do to not get flustered, to not fall into emotion, to take you out of your game? Because people are trying to take you out of your game.
Yeah.
On a tennis court and in business, you're doing a negotiation, they want to have an upper hand over on you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We don't always, I don't think, make these, you know, apple to apple comparisons, but it's there, right? Because we're humans and we're emotion led, and we have to be able to manage that effectively.
What if you don't mind sharing, what's your mantra?
So two, it's in the main one is go from here.
Nice. I like that one. That's really
go
good.
Go from here. So you make a mistake, you know, unforced error, whatever, go from here. So it's pot, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I guess it's self-explanatory, but it's short. Practice it, you know, because when you're in the heat of the moment, it's hard to, you practice tennis court matches, you know, practice court. And then another one, this is new. And this just came up in a training I did the other day, and I'm borrowing it from a newcomer, young woman who just moved here from Paris. She got caught in the COVID. She was supposed to transfer here 2 years ago, got caught in COVID. She's 10 years in the company, and she's a salesperson.
Yeah.
And the idea of in sales and luxury sales, we make judgments. And as a recruiter, you make judgments.
Yep.
I'm going to just go out on a limb and say that you see somebody, how they're dressed, what their school, what their education background is, how well they speak English or we make judgments, right?
Yep.
It can harm you. It can, if you're predisposed to making a judgment that's not really based on, it can cause, and on the, on the opposite, if you have an open mind, if you recognize and value and welcome diversity in those terms, it can benefit you. So her mantra, she taught me the other day, because it was part of a training that I was doing about cultural transformation. And she said, she's like, what you said about diversity and being an open mind, she's like, that's what I try to do. And what I say to myself is child's mind.
Ooh, that's a good one.
She says, so every day she's in the boutique, she tries to have a child's mind. Meaning somebody comes in wearing, you know what I mean, right? Yeah. They don't like a typical client of this maison, you know, whatever. But if you predispose and you judge, you might be missing out on an opportunity, right? So that's a new one. And I'm trying to keep that in mind too. It's simple, child's mind. That's come in today. I mean, you're curious. You know, I'm talking to Dr. Sweet, you know, I'm not trying to sound smart or, you know, that'd be hard for me anyway, but that's not the purpose. It's about being curious and having an open conversation, you know, this kind of stuff. And I think it's beneficial in any kind of, with my kids, you know, whatever in life. So anyway, there's two. That was a long answer.
That's a good one. I like go from here and child's mind.
Yeah.
I ran a 100K race.
Wow.
And I spent the first, I think I spent then. So yeah, plenty of time to think, right? A little bit different than in competitive.
100K or 100 miles?
100K, 100 kilometers.
Okay, man.
And I spent the first hour just thinking of all the things I was thankful for. And boy, you know, after 7-8 hours of running, the mindset is in just a positive space after having just set that the stage for that. So I think, you know, go from here, child's mindset, and, you know, just having that positive, you start off with that positive frame. Creating a frame is huge, I think. And that that really works. But my favorite that I stole from a running podcast I listened to was and I saved this one for about kilometer 40 in a marathon is release the Krakens.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Like that's like beast mode kind of.
Beast mode, getting it. Yeah, and you got to have that energy too, right? Sometimes you got to be a rock star and get that going.
So when 100K. That's ultra then. That's
Yeah, that's and that's, you find a lot out about yourself after the wheels start falling off.
Oof. That's brutal.
So talking about framing, let's move framing from the personal, because we've talked about, you know, the person. Let's bring it to a company. And I know that you've helped companies around values.
Mm-hmm.
You've worked with world-class companies like, you know, Adidas and Nissan and Cartier. Talk about creating values and how that works for a company. How does that drive a company?
Well, yeah, that's a big topic. I'm thinking of how to have it be in a sort of a digestible way and organize my thoughts a little bit, but. I have, and it's an interesting thing because I have done it from the perspective of, you know, from impact when I was helping companies do that, right. That, you know, from a consulting perspective, you know, doing training programs to help people connect with those. And then from an internal perspective, so Adidas had its core values and then Nissan, the new Nissan way. And then now I'm actually doing, and it's pretty interesting when I step back and look at them, there are differences about, you can see how a culture is manifest or how it's exemplified through the values that they say they value and then what they actually do. But how do I do it? I mean, you know, I think that there are things, it requires consistent persistence, as you said. I like that. It's not something that's overnight. Obviously.
Yeah.
There's a certain amount of fatigue that comes from this kind of thing. I've noticed it. So right now I'm a current company. I'm in it. We're doing something. We have something that I basically came up with it's called DARE 2. Mm-hmm. So we have a brand around it, and it's an acronym that fits well with our company competencies.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to do with also the kind of culture that we want to create. And so DARE 2 stands for diversity and inclusion. So one team, you know, and this topic I was saying about when clientele comes in, you know, having, you know, so diversity,
mm-hmm.
accountability,
mm.
yay. R is for risk taking. E is for excellence, not perfection. That's an important distinction for this. Mm-hmm. And then the 2 is for two-way feedback.
Okay.
So this is the values that we are right now. So I'm doing workshops on this. We've done it in the office. Now we're rolling this out to the boutiques. We've done videos around it with the executive committee. You know, 5 of them contributed to this video that we're using as a communication tool. And what I want to say about it is, we can do all the workshops, we can have all the videos, we can do all this stuff, but if it's not something that's really repeated at every opportunity by the executives, you know, when we say, hey, you know, I recognize this or this, you know, or if it's not reflected in, you know, what's evaluated, it's really hard to get it to be part of the core of the company that people get behind. I think the key for it is, where is it coming from? Who's talking about it? Do they talk about it with conviction?
Mm.
You know, because it can have, you know, like people tell me, not, man, so last year we had this, 2 years ago we had this catchy phrase. You know, what's different about this? I'm behind it. You know, I want to do it, but what's different about this? And yeah. So you explain it. And so that, and Nissan was the same. Nissan's really good about that, as far as it being a major initiative, a major engagement, very bureaucratic.
Yeah.
You see how this, but the development of it, the new Nissan way, it's a couple of years in the making. So that's kind of interesting how the difference there. Adidas, very, very simple.
Mm-hmm.
The 3 C's, collaboration, confidence, and creativity.
Mm-hmm.
3 C's. That's what we want, and the simplicity of that is massive. And that came from, that was a global initiative, but I think it was successful because of the simplicity and also because of the, you know, it's from the CEO of the whole company all the way down talking about it. There's buy-in. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that what you know, just to kind of go back to what you said about, you know, persistence. And consistency, really key for this to take hold, because otherwise people get tired of it and it's like, ah, we heard this before, been there, done that.
You know?
So that's for introducing those values and making them last. That's key.
Yeah, there's a lot to unwrap there, I think. I mean, the big takeaways, right, is you're not going to ever make it. There's not an end game, right?
That's right.
So it's always educating. It's always using that opportunity to express those values to the team. Do you think, I've seen a lot of, I've worked with companies where they roll out these values. A lot of times you put together a committee and you decide on what this is, or you bring in an external consultant and, they walk you through your values and you come up with your core values to work on.
Right.
I've also seen that where top management says, this is our values, and they move from there.
Mm-hmm.
And part of me thinks, wow, well, if top management will at least have the buy-in, they're going to walk the talk.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a kind of mixture around all of that. I think, what do you know, especially in Japan, because that's where we're at, what do you think works best for, you know, foreign companies here, especially when the values come from overseas, they're coming from France, New York, wherever, and then they have to implement them here, right?
Yeah. That's a good question. That my hesitation is, I've got my wheels in my mind are working because I've had various experiences with that particular aspect.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, coming from, like in the Adidas case, it was coming from Germany, you know, that was done at, through a process with the executive team, with the consultant that got, you know, brought that out, and they narrowed it down and communicated it that way. Mm-hmm. And I think it was very powerful. I think the simplicity of it, you know, who's not going to agree with those three things are really important. I think that worked very well. On the other end of the spectrum here, the one I was talking about just a moment ago, the Dare 2, that was developed here in Japan. It's not a Cartier global framework. It's a Japan one. But the reason it works here, I believe it's working, is it's based on data and feedback that we know about the company.
Mm.
Where we need to develop. So we have employee engagement barometer. We have 360 feedback for managers. We have other kinds of tools that we use to measure where we are, where we want to go. And so we've identified the things, you know, and then look at the context of our business environment right now, VUCA world, big time, right? We're in a state where we need agility. We need people to challenge. We need to change your trajectory of the sales. You know, the trajectory right now is not going to get us where we need to be.
Mm.
We need to change it. What do you need to do differently? Like all these things come together. It's like, there's the story.
Yep.
To tell us these are the values. And if you can tell that story, where they weren't just pulled out of a hat. The people, the company, the business environment is telling us this is what we need to do. Right. And this is where if we do these things well, if we really, you know, not perfectly, but if we can do them well, that's going to get us to this real target that we're aiming for. So I think I don't think there's a one size fits all. I think it depends on the, and then Nissan in the middle of that is so different. It is by committee, literally by committee, you know, process. I mean, they had the Nissan way for 20 years, Carlos Ghosn.
Yeah.
And then there's new Nissan way. The new Nissan way has been launched, but it took about 2 years of development, and that fit for Nissan, you know? So I think it depends on the environment, the culture of the organization. And I think to go into it, if you're a consultant, you know, I think it's having an open mind about what's going to be best for that organization, or if you're learning a development professional, you know, what is the best for that particular culture that you're working with. And so I think that having, you know, for me, that's one of the things I value the most about my kind of diverse career so far is that I'm able to see these various aspects.
What would you advise around L&D? It could be values, but it could be any L&D initiative for companies that don't have the luxury of someone like you. That, I mean, you've worked with companies that have generous budgets around LD and OD.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these companies, you know, foreign capital companies in Japan, they're just 100, 200 people, and they have an HR person, or they have a couple of people that are around that. And, you know, management have to take some of that responsibility. What are some easy wins that a company can start putting together? If we were to sit down and pick the brains of William Neely, what would we, you come into my company, what would you put in there?
Well, okay. I mean, read about it, Harvard Business Review, you know, LinkedIn Learning, you know, get a subscription to that. You know, that's one of the things that we do in my current company is everybody has a license to LinkedIn Learning, which is a on-demand, very wide-ranging resource for any kind of topic. And I'm sure there's a course, an hour long, or maybe even a learning path.
Yeah.
It could be 5 days worth of stuff about culture transformation or instilling values. I mean, I would say start there, learn it. You know, it's a very democratic world right now to learn and to do this stuff. You know, this is my job and it's great, but I dip in, I learn, you know, I have my own experience, but I pick stuff up all the time. So I would say start there, pick it up, make it your own. It doesn't have to be perfect. Test and learn, try something out, be confident about it, you know, talk like you know,
yeah.
when you're talking with your team, but also say, you know, like, hey, let's try this. You know, I think that's where I would start. There's plenty of resources. You know, HBR has got really good stuff too about this, all this stuff. One of the things that we use a lot, and it occurred to me that the first experience I had with DISC was with you. It was with you. I remember it was probably the first time I spent. I mean, so to get me to the point is use tools to test and measure and feel what the culture is about and to understand that. So use tool. Yep. We use that. We're using DISC now.
I still use DISC. Use it for all my hiring and training for all my staff.
So you were the first guy. I remember you did a session at the ACCJ.
Yeah, back in the day.
An hour and a half session on it. DISC. I remember that really well. You know, going to the corners of the room. I do the same kind of thing still. But I, you know, make use and try you know, I don't know if that's, you know, a quick win, but I think again, it's, you know, dip in and learn, you know, be a learner, be an agile learner, you know, demonstrate that and then try it. That's what I would suggest.
We started, you know, back in the day, and this was pre LinkedIn learning and all the resources that you did have available. We started, you know, we'd read books. And so we started doing what's teachbacks, and we still do teachbacks, where, you know, we'd read a book together. And it's, you know, almost an office book club, or doing a lunch and learn. And it was as diverse as we would do things about stress management or yoga or communication skills or sales skills, whatever. But what we found was more than money, education and challenge was a better factor for retention.
Hmm.
And so I can't stress for, that's why sitting down with you and sharing your story and knowledge is priceless for a lot of companies in Japan, because if they're not implementing things, they should. If they don't have time, they should make time, because it's the most important time that they'll have.
Mm. Mm. Yes. Yes. And like you said, I like the lunch and learn. We suggested that, or, you know, that kind of thing. Is don't forget about the internal knowledge that you have. You know, you've got experts in different things, and learn and teach back. I think that's great. And that, to me, that's a real definition of a learning culture.
Yep.
That's a learning culture, not hiring a consultant or a trainer to come in and teach something. But if you're teaching each other in an organization, that's sustainable, that's motivating, that's, you know, it's a catalyst. So all of that.
So on the flip side of that coin is what pitfalls should companies stay clear of, do you think, around EDOD?
One thing that you see a lot that can cause a bit of skepticism, let's say, or waste, is not following up, you know, starting and not finishing, because it's, you know, whether it's a training, whether it's a, you know, a lunch and learn, we created something called Knowledge Hub, where we have, you know, internal employees talking about their area of expertise to people as wider. It's kind of like a lunch and learn, but we use it as virtual. Follow through with it. No, you know, have a next step, because it's not just that moment. learning requires follow-up. I think the title of this podcast today might be Persistent Consistency. I think it just encapsulates so much, because you do something, even a little bit. It's like, I guess, you know, the 1% rule.
That 1%, yeah.
Yeah, that trajectory. If you look a year from now, do you want to be here? Or, you know, so do that 1%. That's it, you know. And so the things that you're doing, what are you 1% better than you were? And if you're doing a train, so a pitfall might be, yeah, we did this, you know, a 360 survey for all our managers. And then what happened? What did you do with it? Was there follow-up? Like, that's the part. Because if there's not, it can have the reverse effect, right? It can have the opposite effect at which you're looking. People become, you know, jaded, or it's worse than having maybe not done it in the first place. So yeah. I think that's one thing that in any place I've been, where you see success, it could be something about talking to a manager. You know, if you take a training, okay, one of the things they need to do after is share that with your manager, share that with your team. What'd you learn?
Yep.
That's a follow. It's simple. I'm not saying teach the course over, but share it. If you do a LinkedIn course, share it. What did you learn? Spend 15 minutes at the next team meeting to say, this, hey, I did this course. This is the key learning that I took out of it. I wanted to share it with y'all. So those kind of things.
I applaud that. That's spot on. Yeah, I think that's the biggest in my experience with training. It's the biggest pitfall. You have the managers that need to tick off that box, training box, did it for the quarter, the year, done. Same with appraisals. I mean, 1 year appraisals, it doesn't help develop anyone. It's just check boxes. That's part of the reason I think I moved. Part of the reason I moved towards a more coaching centric for what I implement within our organization or for myself, because it's sustained. You keep on doing it. It's not coming in and doing a training session. You have a coach that you meet every week or every other week, and it holds accountable, and there's sustainable change, right? That's what you're looking for.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. Well, you've shared a lot of information. Anything you'd leave us with? Any tips? Well, what's our omiyage for the day, William?
Yeah. Okay. So the question is: leave us with the crystallized wisdom that I've got in the 15 years of my. That's a tough one. I don't know. I think what I would say, I'm on the journey myself.
Yeah.
Right. I feel like the value that I add is that I'm along for the ride, and I want to represent that. I think that I'm a curious person. I might have some expertise in some areas because I've been doing it now, and because I dive in and try to learn, and I share that. I share my vulnerability. I think that's important for me, not everybody. You know, we talk about DISC and you talk about personality styles and things like that. But for me, it's like, be open, yeah. Be curious, say if you don't know something, it's okay. That's, you know, because other people can learn from what you don't. If you ask a question and say, you know, you're not the only person that doesn't know that thing. And I think that if we can, when we talk about learning culture in an organization, if a lot of people are that way, including the CEO, including the executive team, it creates a space where, you know, to use the term that's going around a lot right now, psychological safety. People are, it's okay to not know, but learn. It's okay to not know, but what are you going to do? Learn really good at this, but what are you going to do to improve it? And having that kind of approach is I think that's the kind of company I want to work for. It's the kind of family that I want to raise. It's the kind of friends I want around. I think it's one of the things that I connected with you early on, just in one early conversations is just, you know, you say, hey man, you know, what do you know? Let's talk about this, you know, like that. And I think, you know, that's what I'd want to say. I encourage that kind of curiosity and openness. And I think that can really create a company where people want to work.
That's awesome. But it reminds me of a mantra I've heard, maybe child's mind.
Hey, boom, there it is.
Love it.
There yeah. it is.
You've really encapsulated that. Well, thank you for sharing your wisdom and your experience. You are a generous and conscientious and down-to-earth guy. And it's always energetic to talk to you. I always get energized. We're always back and forth. I loved it. So thank you for sharing today, William.
Bet. Thank you, David.